Christopher Robin's Healthy Dose of Nostalgia frames a story that explores how a change of perspective can change everything. Are you just watching? Episode 84, Christopher Robin. Welcome to the podcast that shares critical thinking for the entertained Christian. I'm E. Franklin.
I'm Tim Martin.
And we decided to do something a little bit, quieter and more kid-friendly. Closer to normal, family-friendly, not superheroes, not science fiction, a little bit fantasy. But it's more of like a walk down nostalgia lane.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it?
Yeah. Though, to be honest, I don't think I really hung out that much with Winnie the Pooh when I was a child. I don't think that it was, I knew who Winnie the Pooh was, but I don't think that I spent a lot of time, wandering around in the 100-acre wood with all of the characters. So, I knew who they were, but I don't know that I ever actually read any of the stories. Let's put it that way.
I read the books, but I was very young. Mm-hmm. Actually, it may just have been the one book, like bedtime story type stuff, when I was probably even sub-grade school age, before school.
Yeah, so, I kind of wanted to see Goodbye Christopher Robin last year, and I never got around to seeing it. I may check it out of the library and watch it at some point.
I had forgotten about that movie.
Yeah, and I think I completely missed it coming out or something. I remember the build-up to it. I wanted to see it. And so this movie, Christopher Robin, I guess when I saw it was in theaters somehow, I thought it was the same movie. It isn't the same movie, but it's a very fun look at a grown-up Christopher Robin. The person I went to the movie with said that they were hoping it would be something in the vein of Saving Mr. Banks, which is a movie that I don't believe I've ever seen.
I have seen Saving Mr. I don't think it's called Saving Mr. Banks, though, is it? It's the story of Mary Poppins, bringing Mary Poppins to screen, right?
I haven't seen the movie, so I don't know how much this one was like it, but
It definitely had the same feel.
Yeah.
I could get behind that statement.
Yeah, she said that she really appreciated it. So going into it with expectations like that, she was happy.
And it had the same nostalgic feeling.
Mm-hmm.
It brought in the people who remembered Mary Poppins and the young children who might appreciate Mary Poppins. But I think, as with Christopher Robin, I think it missed the coveted
target audience,
18 to 35 demographic.
Yeah.
People who weren't exposed to Winnie the Pooh when they were growing up and have no adult who would drag them to the theater now.
Yeah. And it missed its target audience for children as well. I mean, it was rated PG, but I feel like it was not really a kid's movie. And not because the content wasn't kid-friendly. It was very kid-friendly. I think it was aimed at an older audience because of the nostalgia and the pace of the movie. It was not a fast-moving, happy movie. It was actually kind of slow-starting and a little dreary. So it's not something that kids are going to follow very well.
Yeah, this was a deeper movie than most children could appreciate. And I honestly, because the deepness of the movie was centered around the responsibilities of the difference between being an adult and being a imaginative child.
Mm-hmm.
I think most older kids, 13 through 18, I think they would not appreciate it at all. I might be wrong.
Yeah. I mean, there's aspects of it that they would find fun, but I think the parts that we're talking to children would be too young for them, and the parts that are talking to adults would be too old for them. So it definitely is missing a range there.
Yeah.
And because it is talking about once you get old and have the responsibilities of being an adult on your shoulders, you lose touch with your childhood. And I think that was basically the main theme of the movie. And that, like you said, that doesn't really speak to older children.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's a pretty rare child who would be able to really latch on to that concept. And even mm-hmm. then, I would think it would be because they are very observant and mm-hmm. empathetic to the adults around them, more than experience on their part.
I thought that a point I read in your notes about how the different characters kind of line up with what was going on in Riley's head in Inside Out. I thought that was a really interesting observation, because when you pull together, you know, Piglet and Eeyore's kind of sadness, and Piglet is fear, and so they are very much like Inside Out in that aspect. And so I think when you actually have the stuffed animals on screen, I think that there is aspects of the story that the kids would be entertained by. They just don't have enough screen time. Most of them don't even come in until towards the end of the movie.
Yeah, the personalities of the filmmakers were very true to the personalities of the inhabitants of the Hundred Acre Wood. Mm-hmm. I was sitting there going, that is definitely something that that Pooh would say, or definitely something that Rabbit would do, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And frankly, the quality of animation even still astounds me.
Mm-hmm.
I had no problem at all.
Yeah, they really look like stuffed animals coming alive.
Yeah, I didn't even feel like I had to suspend my disbelief, because there was no disbelief. They were up on the screen and it made perfect sense to me.
Yeah. Yeah. And I kept thinking, they really do look like real stuffed animals that are moving and talking.
And, you know, I don't know what it was about Pooh's nose. You know what it was? I had a Winnie the Pooh when I was growing up, a little stuffed one. And he had a hard plastic nose, a shiny, you know, black plastic nose. And,
he had a yarn nose.
Yeah. Not long into the movie, I noticed that his nose was yarn. And for some reason, I became fixated on it. And I noticed that in the animation, you could easily make out each individual, you know, thread of yarn on the close-ups. Mm-hmm. The attention to the detail and the animation, and you could almost feel like you could reach out and touch them. The way the technology has improved, allowing this level of interaction.
Yeah, in live action and animation mix.
Yeah, and that actually was the other part of it, I think. Hollywood has gotten so much better since, say, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, at live action people interacting with CGI characters. Mm-hmm. At no time did I feel like one of the live action actors was not looking at the right place or interacting the right way. It all felt cohesive.
Right. I saw a video where they were talking about to the actors about, you know, filming this movie, and they all agreed that it wasn't hard for them at all, because they would have the stuffed animal filling the spot. And then they would animate it later. And so they were also familiar with the personalities and what, you know, the characters would say, that they had no problem whatsoever imagining a talking poo.
Yeah.
You know? So I guess it was part of it is the nostalgia factor, was that these were not made up characters for just this movie. They were characters that the actors had known and loved their whole lives.
Yeah. Very easy to invest in.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I, you know, that level of animation makes me want to get the DVD just for the extras so I can see the making ofs.
Yeah, it'll be cool.
Yeah.
But before we get too far into this, I do want to mention the music. It is by Jeff Zanelli and John Brion, two guys that I've never heard of before.
And we've never mentioned before. Yay! It's a Disney movie, not done by the Italian Iraqi guy.
We can never say his name. Though I think Zanelli is Italian. So.
Uh-oh. Watch, I'll look him up and he'll be like Chinese.
I thought that the score was very, I wouldn't say unimpressive, but it just, it didn't stand out, which is, like I have said many times, is a good thing. It means that it blended seamlessly with the movie and you didn't notice the music, but it added atmosphere and to all the scenes. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just going to play a little bit of it here, of one of the more active parts of the movie, for you to listen to. So yeah, I thought the music blended, and that's about all I can say. I mean, it's not something I'm going to buy and listen to for fun, but it worked well for the movie.
Yeah, it wasn't standout, but...
It didn't stand out as bad. It didn't stand out as too good either.
And it fit. It really fit, did. Yeah. It flowed with the, you know, the happy and sad memory mix that mm-hmm. made up this movie.
I felt like it fit the era well, because we're not talking about a modern day movie. We're talking about a movie that's portraying time after, was it World War One?
Two.
Two.
Yeah, I had to give some thought to that, but I went off the model of cars they were driving.
Yeah, that makes sense. The other thing that I really appreciated in this movie was the use of color, which I think is a significant thing in all of the Pooh storybooks and mm-hmm. and illustrations, is, you know, how dominant the color red is and how the colors are all very bright, monochromatic.
Yeah.
The red balloon I looked up the red balloon because it was such a prominent part of the movie.
Yeah.
I was curious to see where it fit in, you know, the brand of Pooh.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess they said in some of the stories, the balloon was almost its own character.
Yeah.
So I thought that was very well done. And the little details, like Eeyore missing his tail and having to put it back on again, it was always a thing that was going on in the Pooh stories.
Yeah. Christopher Robin getting stuck, getting out of the tree. And I don't know mm-hmm. if you noticed, he said, "Now I know how it feels." Because, mm-hmm. you know, there's a staple in the Pooh stories is Pooh not being able to get out of his hole because he gets stuck because he ate too much honey.
Yeah. And the honey is almost a character in this movie too. Of course, it usually is with Pooh because he's always needs his honey. And, but we could talk about that later. Those are just some details that, you know, popped out at me that were very important. And the use of color was definitely, I thought, because they're living in a very drab post-war world and everything's gray. And so when you start introducing those spots of color, they really stand out. And
yeah, the fact that they were living in this post-war world, I think, was craftily integrated, including something I'll talk about in a little bit where, Christopher Robin in his work is responsible for ensuring that people who left their job to take care of the war effort stayed employed mm-hmm. with Winslow. Is that the name of the company?
I don't remember.
The luggage company.
Yeah,
anyway,
it was a luggage company.
So he's responsible for people that they promised they would employ.
Mm-hmm.
And I like how they kept the shadow of the war just passed, you know, just over the horizon, just behind the shoulder, in such a way that it made it easy to sympathize with the characters.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I didn't like, I don't want to say it's the only thing I didn't like, but it's the only thing that really stood out to me as a specific thing, was that there's this subplot, and I even hesitate to call it that, where Christopher Robin's next door neighbor, yeah, distraction, that's exactly what it was, is constantly pestering him for the first third of the movie about when they're going to get together for their gin rummy game. And he was a caricature of a neighbor, not a real neighbor, you know?
Yeah, I think it's kind of like that neighbor who's wanting to spend time with you and you're always putting them off and making excuses. And I think at some point Christopher Robin must have made some excuse to him and it got stuck in his head. So it was always that we're going to play that gin rummy game kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I understand the use of the character, but I don't know what his purpose was in the movie. And he's kind of a throwaway, a distraction.
Yeah.
The only thing I can think of is that they needed a way to drive Christopher Robin out into the park across the street from his townhouse. Mm. And
hiding out.
Yeah, to hide from the neighbor, and which gave that hole when he finds Pooh the first time. So I don't know.
Yeah, it seems like a sort of long setup to give him an excuse to go hide.
He drops him after that.
Yeah, I feel like there was supposed to be more to him, and they had to leave it on the cutting room floor.
It may have been, I don't know. Like he had something to do with the end, I don't know. But yeah, he seemed like more of a distraction than anything else.
Yeah. You had a comment in yours about in the stories, Christopher Robin's father is always absent.
I had read that somewhere.
I don't remember his mother much in the stories either. It was always just Christopher Robin and the denizens of the Hundred Acre Woods. Did you have something specific in mind there?
Well, it was just that I had been reading up on the Red Balloon, and I had noticed some articles that were talking about the fact that there are a lot of stories that have the mother and the nanny in them, but the father's never mentioned. Huh. And so I don't, as having not read the Winnie the Pooh stories myself, I can't say that for sure. I was just something I dug up when I was researching the Red Balloon. And the father is never mentioned. It's like the fatherless Christopher Robin kind of thing.
Yeah.
And yet at the beginning of this movie where they're showing the chapters of Christopher Robin's life, you see his father, you know, because his father is taking him to school in a very absent kind of way. But yeah, I thought that was interesting that our whole discussion is going to probably hinge quite a bit on a father and child relationship, because that's, a predominant theme of this movie. And the fact that Christopher Robin himself, his father's never mentioned in the stories.
Before we get to that, I wanted to mention the only review that I read before going to see it was this article in Christianity Today. It was part review and part discussion on nostalgia and its use not only in Christopher Robin, but in Hollywood in a more general sense, and how Christians should be approaching it. And basically, I'll put the link to the article in the show notes, but it comes down to as long as you keep it in perspective, it's good. Like anything. But as soon as you idolize it, it's bad.
Yeah.
But it did bring to mind to me how much of the fare that we're seeing, and frankly, that we're reviewing here on Are You Just Watching, in the last year or two has been derivative, either a sequel or a reboot or a reimagining. It just seems like there's less and less
original content.
Original content, yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you know, the father-son story in Pursuit of Happiness, which I think was the first movie I did with you, right?
It is, yes.
It felt original, even though it touched on many of the same themes that we're going to be discussing today. But the parent-child interaction that we're discussing today, while well done, felt derivative to me and really seemed to be lacking original content. And I'm wondering if it's just my perception, or is it indicative of a larger trend, you know, in mass media? I don't know what's going on. Maybe it's the Marvel effect.
Yeah, it could be the Marvel effect. It could be I think maybe a lot of Hollywood studios are trying to you know, take a fast track to success. And whenever you chase something original, there's that element of risk as to whether it's going to fit the market and whether people are going to enjoy it. And so I don't know. Maybe they're just not willing to take the risk on original stuff, because it is risky. You don't know if, you know, you get a feel for your market. And you, like you said, when we started this, is like there is that target of the 18 to, you know,
34 or whatever.
34 or whatever it is. Yeah. And they've got it twisted into their head what will make that market come and buy popcorn and sit for 2 hours. I don't know. I mean, there probably have been some original movies that have come out that we've maybe missed or that were rated R.
Yeah.
I thought Arrival was pretty original, and we just did that one earlier this year. There's stuff out there. It's just, it probably, they're a little scared of, you know, what, how the market will accept it and what the reviews are going to be.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've mentioned on the podcast before that I host trivia two nights a week, and one of the things I have to do is select music to play in between the songs. And for the songs between the questions, I always do theme songs, but three times during each show I do music from the current music charts. And recently, of the top 50 songs on the top 100 chart, 47 of the top 50 were flagged explicit.
Yeah. That could be the other thing, is that stuff's, you know, rated in such a way that we can't watch it.
Yeah, exactly. It's, I think maybe the original movies, like you said, are achieving that higher rating that's outside of our fare.
Yeah.
It's a shame.
Yeah, yeah, it is.
Why can't they come up with original stories that don't have cussing and rampant sex and everything?
That's another thing, you know, my observation that they're concerned about, you know, hitting their market, their target market, and, you know, what kind of reviews they're getting. The explicit nature of our culture, I think a lot of times they throw that stuff in order to reach the audience. It's a gimmick. It's like, they may not watch this for the story, but, you know, they might watch it for this.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I don't know. It would be an interesting study to find out what's driving the whole nostalgia reboot and all that kind of stuff. Because we've rebooted Star Trek. We've rebooted Star Wars. We've got another Mary Poppins movie coming out.
Yeah. We have Disney's really jumping on that bandwagon.
Yeah.
Live action of all the animated films that they're doing.
Mm-hmm. All their classic animated films are coming out in live action. It's definitely a trend. So we'll see where it carries us.
Well, you know what the good book says in Ecclesiastes 1:9. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun.
Nope. I love Ecclesiastes.
Isn't there a Shakespeare quote like that? It's every story, it's probably not Shakespeare.
Has been told.
Yeah, yeah. Every story has been told.
Yeah, probably.
Probably apocryphal or proverb of some type.
Well, you know, that's a great tie-in, because the first thing that I want to talk about for Christopher Robin, and, you know, we've kind of been talking in general, so from now on we'll probably be hitting spoilers if you haven't seen the movie yet.
I forgot about that part.
If you haven't seen the movie yet and you don't want anything spoiled, this would probably be a good time to stop listening, go see the movie, and then come back. Mm-hmm. If you don't care, if you don't worry about being spoiled, keep listening, because we probably won't spoil the movie too bad.
Oh, and if you do, pause here and go watch the movie. Would you get me some popcorn?
But tying in the whole, there's no new stories. Mm-hmm. This whole setup for Christopher Robin is storybook style. And I thought that was really beautifully framed.
Yeah.
Because we start out the movie with a very young Christopher Robin saying goodbye to his friends in the Hundred Acre Wood, because he is being sent off to boarding school. And after he's dropped off at the school, the movie skips forward by turning pages in a book, showing, well, and this is the chapter of the life where he went to school, and this is the chapter of life when his father died, and this is the chapter of life when he goes to war, when he gets married, when he has a kid. And so they're like skipping through his life like they're turning pages in a book. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was beautifully done. It's slow, and the kids probably won't follow it, but it was beautifully done, and I really appreciated that.
An appropriate frame for the story itself. Mm-hmm.
But what was interesting about these chapters of Christopher Robin's life is that we're seeing his joy and his innocence of his childhood stripped away one chapter at a time. Mm-hmm. You know, you start out in the happy Hundred Acre Wood, where it's not really happy because they're saying goodbye, and making promises to each other, never to forget each other. And then we see him stripped away by one event after another. It's like the first is being disciplined at school for daydreaming mm-hmm. about Winnie the Pooh. And then we see, you know, the death of his father.
Yeah. And actually, there's a little bit right there. There's mm-hmm. a scene at the wake where, mm-hmm. And you know, it's such a stereotypical scene when you just discuss it, that he's sitting on the stairs at the wake and one of the old women of the neighborhood or maybe a family member comes up and says, "You're the man of the house now."
Mm-hmm.
But the way they did it really spoke to the artistry they were putting into it and mm-hmm. loaded it with emotion, more so than I can give it credit for in this discussion.
Yeah.
But it, like you're saying, it when with the delivery of that line, it stripped away another
layer of innocence.
Piece yeah. of what made Christopher Robin the master of the Hundred Acre Wood.
Yeah, and then we see him get married and, you know, the responsibility of family and the going away to war. And it's just that with each turn of the page, it's like you're taking him further down, you know, into bleak despair. And he's basically being crushed by life. And it seems like as we're going through the movie that he's got a life that he's lost all purpose or joy. And it made me think of, you know, just and we've talked about this. It was one of the main things we talked about when we did the Inside Out movie was what is happiness? What is joy? Mm-hmm. And I think that joy comes from, at least from a Christian heart, it comes from a godly perspective on life and a purpose for living. And because Christopher Robin's purpose was stripped away by all of these, you know, heavy things going on in his life, it brought up a few pieces of scripture for me. And one of them is Proverbs 17:22. A joyful heart is good medicine, but a crushed spirit dries up the bones. And I think that is that proverb really fits this movie because it starts out with him with a crushed spirit. And that's everything in his life is being dictated to by how his spirit has been crushed by all of this.
You're right. It could almost be a tagline for the movie, couldn't it?
Yeah. But the joy of a childhood and the innocence of a childhood that he recaptures in this movie is where the joy comes from. And it gives him a new perspective on life. And so joy heals that and he's lost his joy.
Mm-hmm.
And then near the end of Ecclesiastes, which I've already said is one of my favorite books, Ecclesiastes 8:14-15 says, "There is vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I said that this also is vanity, and I commend joy. For man has nothing better under the sun but to eat, drink, and be joyful, for this will go with him in his toil through the days of his life that God has given him under the sun." So this is one of those oxymorons, this conflict that is in scripture, that people who live righteous lives can have the worst things happen to them. And then you have these wicked people who are wealthy and famous and, all the good things in life are coming to them. And and it's a paradox that it's hard to deal with sometimes. And
like maybe the guy who goes and plays golf while all of his employees are working.
Or being worried about losing their jobs.
Yeah.
You know, the writer of Ecclesiastes, King Solomon, says, "But I commend to you joy," because that's what makes all of that worthwhile, is living in a state of joy. And then in Galatians 5:22-23, bringing this up into the New Testament, that the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such things there is no law. So this is that picture of what the Spirit does to Christians, because it's easy to get lost when you're getting, you know, heavy things piled on you on top of it all. And we all have heavy things in our lives. And I think I brought this up a little bit when we were talking about the red pill in our last two episodes, that if you bring a perspective of joy to the hard things in your life, then you don't let them push you down and you can get past those with purpose and meaning, regardless of the circumstances that are in your life. That's just kind of a real brief overview of the way they portray Christopher Robin in this movie, and doesn't necessarily go delve into what we want to talk about later, but I wanted to point that out from the get-go that what's lacking in his life is joy. He's lost the innocence of childhood, and he doesn't have a purpose to replace it with.
Yeah.
And one other little quick thing that I noticed, and I don't know really how it fits in our discussion, but did you notice that Pooh kind of just wakes up when the honey touches his picture? And I almost got the feeling that this all this time that has passed in Christopher Robin's life, that all of the characters went to sleep. And so, and that's the reason why Pooh can't find his friends, because everybody is missing, because it's part of Christopher Robin's missing childhood. And so Pooh's the first one that wakes up, and the other ones haven't woken up yet. And the other ones don't appear. The Hundred Acre Wood is empty when he and Pooh get back to it. And they don't appear until he loses Pooh and he starts looking for Pooh. And then the others appear.
Yeah, they're sort of parceled in, almost like their own introductions.
Mm-hmm. I just kind of felt like that was an indication of awakening going on inside of him. Like the Hundred Acre Wood was sleeping, and it was as he was waking up, they were waking up.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. It's kind of like almost a showing of progression in his character.
I didn't notice while I was watching it, but I wonder if there was a correlation between Christopher Robin's mood as he was looking for Pooh and the characters that he encountered. You know, was he feeling pessimistic when he finally encountered Eeyore floating in the river, or...
Yeah, I think he'd kind of given up looking for Pooh.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there might be some correlation to that, too.
I'm going to have to rewatch it now to find out.
Yeah, it'll be a fun movie to watch again at some point. Well, the next thing that, you know, that kind of just goes into is, speaking of perspective, I really felt like I said, he doesn't have any joy in his life. He's lost his perspective. And there was a scene where he's telling his wife, Evelyn, that he can't go to the cottage with them for the weekend. Mm. And she says, you won't be coming to the cottage. And he says, it can't be helped. And she says, your life is happening now right in front of you. And that was, you know, it's like missing the forest for the trees. It's like he's missing the most important things in his life because he's lost the correct perspective on life. He doesn't have a purpose. He's just going through the motions, and his job is important to him, and it's the, and he's, I guess, kind of putting the job in place of purpose. Yeah. Because that's
it's like, and he's coasting from one responsibility to the other, just almost trying to keep his head above water.
Yeah.
And the weekend that he had planned with Evelyn and Maddie was almost like a life preserver for surviving the workplace, as opposed to the joy of spending time with family.
Right. Which you're just connotating, you know, his keep his head above water when he jumps into the river after Eeyore. Finds out it's only knee deep. But yeah, I think that's all kind of goes together, though. It's another perspective thing. It's like when he's going in after Eeyore, he's looking at the water as he did as a child, you know, that he's going to have to jump into this raging river, and it's just a trickling creek that he's doesn't even reach his knees. So there's a whole ton of perspective stuff in this movie that it's almost like they're hammering it, but it's so skillfully done that you don't really notice it until you start thinking about it.
Yeah.
But the Say What You See game that Pooh plays when they're on the train heading to the cottage.
Tree. Dog.
House. Clouds. He's just very literal. You know, these are the things that I see. And then when he and Madeline are going back.
Yeah.
To chase after Christopher Robin with his case full of important papers, they try to play the game again. And this time they have more of the group there. And so Eeyore goes first and he says, I see disgrace and shame and humiliation. Piglet sees worry, anxiety, and fear. And Tigger sees speed, danger, and recklessness. So it's you get all these different perspectives based on, you know, their personality traits. And I just thought that was kind of funny. It struck me when I was watching the movie, but when I thought back on it, you know, from a why are we watching this movie? What else is there? It was just another one of those perspective things. It's like there's so much in this movie that is all about perspective. It's like how you look at things.
Mm-hmm.
And this was just another one of them.
It really is a major theme in the movie, isn't it? I mean,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
The way that Christopher Robin looked at the Hundred Acre Woods when he was a kid versus an adult. And
mm-hmm.
even the way Madeline sees her father now, you know, when Evelyn says, "Did I ever tell you about your father when he was a kid?" And Madeline says, "Are you sure he ever was one?"
Yeah. And it's amazingly enough, turns out to be the climax of the movie, too, that the whole idea of perspective, looking at a problem from a different point of view, provides a solution.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the climax of the movie. You know, it's like, we're going to fix this problem that, you know, the company isn't making enough money by changing the market instead of getting rid of the employees. And I think that was, you know, it's like, let's quit looking at this. Let's look outside the box for the solution instead of looking inside the box for the solution. And I think that was a really big deal. But then there's also the slight shift of when they realize Madeline is missing. Evelyn comes into town looking because Madeline has run away, you know, and
gone on an expedition.
Yeah. And she comes into the city and tells and interrupts the meeting to tell Christopher Robin that Madeline's missing. And then he realizes that his case of important things or his daughter is a lot more important. And so I feel like, you know, this whole perspective shift through the whole movie was intentionally done.
Yeah, I agree.
They were like showing you how important perspective is and how you look at things. And then it turns out to be such an important climax.
Two tertiarily related comments there.
Yeah.
First, the way that Maddie, for all intents and purposes, a 10-year-old girl, handles herself and goes into, gets on the train, handles the mass transportation system in London, and does everything, reminded me of, we jokingly call it the good old days, but when you and I were much younger, when we were grade school, our parents were much more permissive in what we were and weren't allowed to do as far as ranging far afield and staying out late and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, playing until mom calls me in for dinner.
Yeah,
you know, and she has no idea where I am in the neighborhood.
I, as a kindergartner, once or twice a week, would not be uncommon for me to walk from our house to my grandparents' house a mile and a half away. On the other side of what was a huge town to a 6-year-old.
Yeah, it's interesting that they say now that a lot of the problems with the millennials are the helicopter parenting.
Yeah.
You know, it's like this holding your child so close and making sure they have everything they need, you know, and they never have to think for themselves. They never have to do for themselves. Everything is right there. So, yeah, she definitely exhibits a level of maturity that our 16-year-olds these days don't have.
That's for sure. the other thing was the only time in the movie that I had trouble suspending my disbelief was that the entire solution would be that Winslow's luggage would start giving paid vacation to their thousands of employees. I don't care how big the company is. They are not going to make a dent in their fiscal economy by giving paid vacation to their thousands of employees.
No, that's just not what I think they were doing. I think they were encouraging other companies.
Starting social change.
Yeah, starting social change by making their luggage affordable for the middle and lower classes. Because they were producing luggage that was only available and affordable by the upper classes. And so
the way it should be.
His solution was to create a market for a cheaper and more mass produced item.
Yeah.
So that was the solution.
Okay. Yeah. Still oversimplified.
Yes. Well, it had to be oversimplified because it's a kid's movie.
Yeah. And it was the last 2 minutes of the movie.
Yeah. Done very quickly. Yeah. But yeah, that was to me, I felt like what the solution was that they were looking at a very small targeted market.
Yeah.
And his idea was, let's turn it upside down and create a bigger market.
Back to the entire idea of looking at it differently.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
That really was, you know, like the paper floating around and he picks it up and it's upside down. The pyramid's upside down. So he sees the, you know, so it was all a perspective thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was Eeyore doesn't recognize Christopher Robin when he first sees him. He considers him a heffalump. And it takes quite a bit of convincing on the part of Christopher Robin to convince him that he's not a Heffalump. And Pooh, when he first saw Christopher Robin, you know, says, you're a lot bigger. He's like, well, I'm not a child anymore. I'm an adult. So there's this whole idea of your perspective changes as you get older.
Yeah.
You know, not only are you getting bigger, but... And that leads into the next thing I want to discuss. I'm going to let you close this thing because I'm going to get all of mine in early. But the inevitability of growing up. And as I just mentioned about the millennials, we've got a new verb now in our culture called adulting. And I thought it was so funny. You start hearing even people my age talking about
it. I've used it.
Yeah, about adulting and how hard it is.
I don't want to adult today. And,
yeah. Where that comes from is, you know, the idea of being responsible and doing the things that an adult does. And I think that in every one of us, my dad used to tell me, and he still tells me because he's in his mid-70s. And he's like, I'm an 18-year-old trapped in an old man's body. And when we're growing old, we don't think of ourselves as old. We still think of ourselves as young and in old bodies, you know. It's that immortality of the human spirit. And so I don't think that age doesn't necessarily make an adult. Maturity does. And I think a lot of times we don't teach the skills and knowledge that classify people as mature enough to be adults. And so we have a lot of really old kids, basically, running loose in our culture. That going back to my comment about the millennials, which, let me paraphrase that, not all millennials are irresponsible.
Oh, I don't know about that.
I know a handful that are actually quite responsible.
My children, as you know, are all millennial aged, and it's a running joke in our house that whenever there's a problem with a kid on the TV screen that's the same age as my kids, I'll just go, millennials, man, I hate them. And, you know, it earns me the requisite dirty look bump on the shoulder, you name it. Sorry, didn't mean.
Yeah. No,
please,
I mean,
continue.
Well, that's kind of my point is that we have a generation now that are reaching adulthood that don't act like adults, that don't seem to know how to be adults. But yet we're seeing in a level of maturity in the children in Christopher Robin that even the original Christopher Robin stories, Christopher Robin as a boy was the mature character.
Yeah.
And that he was being the guiding mentor of a group of basically toddler mentalities. Mm. And it's just interesting to me that we see a level of maturity in him as a child and in his daughter, because he expects his daughter to be a little adult.
Yeah.
It's the way he treats her. That there is this idea that maturity is not something that you just automatically have an adult. And experiences age you quicker than years do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, you know, some of the, you know, Christopher Robin got old too fast because of the experiences of his life. They matured him too quickly.
I think that ties back to what we had mentioned before was how mm-hmm. much we as children, you and I, were allowed to experience on our own as children, yet with the helicopter parenting today,
mm-hmm.
the experiential benefit just isn't there anymore. And when we take that even further and look at how Madeline lived the first 10 years of her life dealing with a father who was away at what was, the war to end. World War I, I think, was the war to end all wars. But World War II, dealing with bombings, nightly bombings and radio reports of deaths down the street. And then Christopher Robin growing up, he would have been growing up in just post World War I.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just, I think maybe, and I'm going to sound like an old fogey now, I think maybe part of the reason that we don't see more maturity in the younger generations right now is that they just haven't had the harder experiences. They've had it easier growing up. Now, that's just the way it is. And
they've been shielded from a lot of hard things, yeah, too. It's not that hard things haven't happened, but they've been shielded from them.
Right. I think God's plan is such that it will balance out. Mm-hmm. That those who have grown up in harder environments, financially challenged, or those who deal with racism on a daily basis, or live in environments where terrorists could literally roll into their town and kill people, their village. Mm-hmm. I think that we will see those people rise up, you know, like Nelson Mandela and Desmond Tutu. I hope that it works out that way, and I hope that they are God-fearing people who do.
Well, one of the points that I wanted to make in this was that as we dwell on what it means to become an adult and deal with the responsibility, our perspective as believers in approaching God, Jesus himself said that we were supposed to approach him as children.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a level of innocence and vulnerability that we have to exude, that we have to put ourselves back in that mindset in order to understand the gospel,
yeah,
and to accept the Spirit. And in Matthew 18:2-4, it says, and this is Jesus, and calling to him a child, he put him in the midst of them and said, truly I say to you, unless you turn and become like children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Whoever humbles himself like this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. That is so hard. I mean, it's like we get so set in our ways as we get older. And I know I, for one, am finding myself very domineering. And when I think I'm right, I'm not going to let anybody gainsay me. And I'm acting more like my dad every day. But we have to let go of some of that. We have to be able to return ourselves mentally and spiritually to a state of childhood, in which we turn to our father, our papa, and ask him to make everything better in our lives, because we can't do it ourselves. We have to realize that we aren't in control. And and that's the state of children. They're never in control of their own lives. There's always someone else that's, you know, pulling all the strings.
That ties very heavily into, you know, I'm not going to read the whole thing, but the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes, several of the Beatitudes, the pure in heart, the meek, the hunger, those who hunger and thirst, are all not unique to the childhood mind, but much more common in the childhood mind. And I think that Christ was reinforcing there his comment from Matthew.
Mm-hmm.
Or actually the other way around, because the Matthew 18 came after the Beatitudes.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's interesting that we come at this, you know, this whole idea of perspective, and, you know, you're going to talk more about what that means in balancing work and family. Mm-hmm. But one of the points I wanted to make is that we should try really, really hard not to strip away the innocence and the imagination of our children. Allow them to dream and allow them. I mean, like there was this horrific quote in there from the boss who was saying that dreams don't come for free. You have to work on them. Nothing comes from nothing. So children are natural dreamers, and they think of impossible things. And that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, you can't support them in some degree instead of dashing their hopes and forcing them to grow up too soon. So just a reminder to us to help preserve the imagination and the dreams of our children.
Yeah. And we need to reach for that, that childhood mind ourselves, but not from a place of longing and nostalgia, but from a place of remembering what it's like to be
a child,
utterly trusting and
independent
on God, because that's what we are. It really is just opening our eyes to the reality of the situation and submitting to his will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was able to sympathize, I think, much more with Christopher Robin as an adult and the struggles that he faced, because he and I have been in so many similar situations. I'm an army vet, and I was in for the first Gulf War, though I never saw combat or was deployed to a combat zone. And you know, I've raised kids, and I've been a manager at work with people reporting to me and dependent upon me. And the challenges that he was facing that were portrayed in the movie for the Christopher Robin character were all ones that touched me specifically. And he took his responsibilities very seriously, and he should have. But I want to stress that, you know, when Hollywood portrays a character like that, we have to remember that while we know that we should be taking our responsibilities seriously, we need to keep in mind that there's a reason that we should be taking these responsibilities seriously. Mm-hmm. And it's not just because we're responsible, but because we answer to a higher power. I know I've used it before because it's one of my favorite scriptures. Whatever you do, do it from the heart as something done for the Lord and not for people, mm-hmm. knowing that you will receive the reward of an inheritance from the Lord. You serve mm-hmm. the Lord Christ. And, you know, Christopher Robin, he's responsible for his employees' jobs. When Winslow Jr. makes it clear that they're looking at cutting 20% of the workforce, or 20% of the cost, which may or may not be 20% of the workforce. So all of that got me wondering, you know, what was the common faith in England at the time? And when we had missionaries come into the church, they talk pretty frequently about the secularization of Europe. And I was looking at some figures, and in the 2011 census, 59.5%, almost 60% of respondents in the United Kingdom identified as Christians. Now, keep in mind, of course, that identifying as Christians doesn't mean that they're actually evangelical, Bible-believing Christians.
I'm surprised it's that high.
Yeah, I was
2011.
I was actually very surprised.
Because their percentage of how many people actually attend the churches are drying up and blowing away.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, most of the churches in Europe are lucky if they have 50 members. I mean, they're just really, really tiny.
I read an article, I think it was in Christianity Today as well, that for the first time in recorded history, the number of weddings in Scotland performed by secular humanists is outnumbering the number of weddings performed by religious faith leaders. And as a Presbyterian, this is shocking to me because Scotland is the home of the Presbyterian denomination.
Mm-hmm.
But
across Europe, churches are being turned into nightclubs and tattoo parlors. And
The same statistics suggest that in the time of the setting of Christopher Robin, Christianity was even less popular. One thing I read suggested that around slightly less than 30% of the adult civilization in the United Kingdom in 1918 was identifying as Christian. And I think these numbers are probably closer together with the 1918 probably being a little higher and the 2011 probably being much lower due to the definitions of identifying Christian changing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the point is, you know, Christopher Robin struggled to be responsible, but we need to remember when we're looking at it from a critically thinking Christian viewpoint that the responsibility that we are urged to needs to keep in mind who we serve. And frankly, that responsibility needs to play into how we raise our children as well. One of the struggles Christopher Robin faced was his relationship with Madeline. He clearly tried to be a good father. He was clueless, but he clearly tried to be a good father. And you know, he was struggling.
Yeah. I was just looking up some different stats from possibly a different source. It says UK church membership has declined from 10.6 million in 1930 to 5.5 million in 2010.
Wow.
or as a percentage of the population from about 30% to 11.2%. By 2013, this had declined further to 5.4 million, which is 10.3%. If current trends continue, membership will fall to 8.4% of the population by 2025. In England, membership is forecast to decline from 2.53 million, 4.3% of the population by 2025.
Less than one out of every 10 people.
Yeah.
That's just so astounding.
I don't think that the stats that, you know, people identifying as Christians, if we go by actual church attendance, which, you know, devout Christians typically go to church, I would say there has been a significant decline.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Yeah. It's just, you know, it's so important that we focus on our faith. We focus on who we serve, and we raise our children to do likewise, especially in this increasingly secular world.
Yeah.
And, well, Christopher Robin, you know, he was struggling with not having a childhood experience with his parents that he could draw upon.
And he didn't seem to know how to treat Madeline. It was like this, you know, he was just training her for school, basically, to send her away to school.
Yeah, actually, that was one of the things that it was so quick in the movie, but it stood out to me, was that the scene where Christopher Robin is being dropped off as a 10-year-old at the boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
His parents are standing just outside the door of the car, and they shove him up this exceedingly long walk through the big gates up to the big boarding school. And you can see in the courtyard, there are plenty of families with adults and children hugging and taking their children off, because sending your kids off to boarding school is not necessarily a bad thing. And Christopher Robin even mentions it, that it helps prepare them for the world. Yeah, but,
well, I went to boarding school, so I can tell you it does.
But yeah, it's how his parents did it. And it clearly, or rather, I felt like that it was pinning that distancing on his father.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, his mother really didn't play into the story much at all, much less screen time even that his father had. It really comes down to the impact that Christopher Robin's parents raising him had on him. And reminds us, you know, Proverbs 22:6, start a youth out on his way, and even when he grows old, he will not depart from it. And that particular version is from the CSB.
Mm-hmm.
It really does have an impact on how your children, how you're raised, and how you raise your children.
Mm-hmm.
But Christopher Robin, really, his cluelessness really does come through. I noticed when he first walked in the door, he said, "I'm sorry, I got held up at work." But when he said he can't go to the cottage, when he had already established that he, in a previous scene, that he'd promised to go to the cottage with his wife and daughter, it took him forever to say, "I'm sorry, I can't go."
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe that was a cultural thing for the time. Because the man of the house was the man of the house, and the man of the house did not explain his decisions.
Yeah. Or it could just be a deepening of the character and the fact that he truly did not want to break that promise, and he had no idea how to communicate that he was breaking that promise.
Yeah.
And it added depth to his character that he delayed it as long as he could, trying to find some way to soften the blow, maybe.
Mm. Yeah, I could definitely see that. For me, Christopher Robin's character just kept reminding me of a couple things. There's a devotional that I've used in the past called The Measure of a Man by Gene Getz that has really helped me understand what a godly man is. And mm-hmm. That ties into the church officer's training and the requirements for elder and deacon. In particular, Paul is explaining it in 1 Timothy 3:2-4, where he says, "An overseer, therefore, must be above reproach, the husband of one wife, self-controlled, sensible, respectable, hospitable, able to teach, not an excessive drinker, not a bully, but gentle, not quarrelsome, not greedy. He must manage his own household competently and have his children under control with all dignity. And I feel like Christopher Robin was, you know, reaching for that standard. And I think probably the majority of fathers do. I think that standard is the ideal that even non-Christian fathers strive for, at least in more traditional households.
Yeah. And those are an extinct species.
They know, we know it's important intuitively, but Christopher Robin comes to realize that he must be going about it the wrong way somehow. When Pooh calls him a hero, he says, "I'm not a hero, Pooh, I'm lost." So he knows he's doing something wrong, and I really appreciated that. But you know, seeing Christopher Robin got me wondering about the movie reused a slew of themes and pithy sayings from Winnie the Pooh, which all are, you know, both deep and empty
at the same time.
Yeah. And that got me wondering about a book I had heard about but never read, The Tao of Pooh. And it turned out to only be a 2.5-hour Audible book, so I snagged it, and I've listened to it the last couple of days while walking the dogs and driving to and from work. And that actually got me thinking about the common grace of God and how all of humanity has, we all see certain things, regardless of whether or not we are believers. Romans 2, 4, and 14 and 15 goes, "Or do you desire the riches of his kindness, restraint, and patience, not recognizing that God's kindness is intended to lead you to repentance?" And then jumping to 14. "So when Gentiles, who do not by nature have the law, do what the law demands, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that the work of the law is written on our hearts. Their consciousness confirms this. Their competing thoughts either accuse or even excuse them." And when compared to how the Tao of Pooh, you know, used all of the sayings of Pooh from the stories of Winnie the Pooh, and converts it into Taoism, it made me think of how the world religions all have elements of common grace in them, or most of them. The flying spaghetti monster probably doesn't. But they, you know, they all have elements of the truth in them. They're just not quite there. You know, they're missing the repentance. They're missing the need for salvation. And you know, the entire movie, and this really is going to be a spoiler, the entire movie hinges around something Pooh says early on, that doing nothing often leads to the very best of something. In the Tao of Pooh, you know, the author just snags on to that as a true Taoism. And really,
it's very passive.
it all comes to a quiet meditative mind that should be focused on God.
Yeah, a lot of those Eastern things, they dwell so much on meditation, and they meditate on nothing, because like the whole point of yoga is like to empty your mind and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, the problem is that you open yourself up to all kinds of horrible influences when you do that. You should be filling your mind with God, not just trying to make it blank.
Meditation should be about prayer, meditating on God,
the word of God,
on need for forgiveness and God's grace and his.
It's like the story in the scripture, and I have to look up the reference of the demon, the man who gets the demon cast out, and he doesn't fill that hole with God. And so the demon moves back in with a whole bunch of host of others, you know, and you don't clean your house out in order to not fill it. You have to fill it with something important to you. And like God, you know, obviously, or something inimical will come in and mess it up. So yeah, you can't have a vacuum in your spiritual life. Yeah. There has to, you have to fill it with God.
You know, the consciousness confirms that something is missing.
Right. Yeah. Well, and you know, like you said, they seem like very deep sayings, but in the end, they actually are very empty.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the other one that popped out to me was, there were a couple, people say nothing is impossible, but I do nothing every day.
I love that one.
It says, I always get to where I'm going by walking away from where I've been. They're very purposeless. There's no, you know, it's like doing nothing every day.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. You know.
Where would you get? Nowhere.
Nowhere. And if you're not going, you know, if you're not intentionally going somewhere, you're not going to get anywhere.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I mean, it's just one of those situations where they seem like they're very deep,
yeah.
But there really is no philosophical value to anything that Pooh says. Well,
you know what? That's like the stream that Eeyore is floating down. It was so deep for a young Christopher Robin, but now that he's mature, it's shin deep.
Yeah. And I don't know. I think that's just one of the things that goes with perspective. It's like, you know, like the whole movie has to do with perspective. It's like the things he says could be of value if you have the proper perspective on them. But if you just take them at face value, they're pointless. So, you know, take it for what it is.
Yeah.
Pooh is very literal. I mean, that's his character.
Yep.
And just like he's very literal and Rabbit's very busy and Piglet's very anxious and... You know, they all have, you know, a certain aspect, and you can't just choose one and say, this is the way we should be. You have to take them as a whole.
Yeah.
And Pooh is just one part of the whole. And so that literal way of looking at life is not necessarily, we're not saying that you should look at life like Pooh does. which brings a really fascinating little story to close this up. When I first started working where I work now, we had a employee get together, and each of the departments was supposed to engage in some kind of entertainment for the rest of the group. And we all took turns. Well, we came up with the really grand idea of doing a Winnie the Pooh skit in our department. And so we made our boss, Christopher Robin, and I was the rabbit, and busy, busy, busy rabbit. Mm. And then we had two others that were Kanga and Roo, and then we had Piglet and... And some of the people that were in that skit, and this was probably almost 20 years ago, I still work with. So my boss is still the same. So I was, when I went to see the movie, I kept seeing my boss as Christopher Robin. So it was just kind of fun to put everybody in their role and to remember that I was Rabbit. You just like have that busy, you know, Rabbit really Kangaroo and Rabbit were, I mean, they stayed behind when the rest of the group went on their expedition.
Yeah.
So we didn't, well, get, Kanga, didn't get as much screen time.
I mean, Kanga's characteristic, her defining characteristic was her being maternal, right?
Right.
And Roo's defining characteristic was being not infantile, but...
a child.
Yeah, childish.
Yeah.
So they didn't really...
fit into the story.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you would see that Kanga would fit well with Evelyn, so that when once Evelyn joined them in the in the 100-acre wood, that was, you know, the kind of to get the mother figure back in there. Yeah. So,
let me ask one last question about the perspective issue. Did you feel at any time, like maybe up to maybe 2/3 through the movie, that they could have gone either way with other people seeing
them,
the moving,
like whether they were really
Pooh
moving
and characters, or Christopher Robin having completely had a mental break?
or the fact that they were all treating them like they were actually interacting characters, but they were really lugging around stuffed animals. I don't know. That was an interesting twist. I know there were a lot of people that were concerned about how that was going to be dealt with in the movie, and you know, the way it was done, it didn't bother me. But at the same time, it would have been fascinating with it being, you know, because in the stories, I always felt like the 100-acre wood was Christopher Robin's fantasy world.
Yeah, me too.
You know, and the characters in it were his imaginary friends, you know, that he was laying out picnics with his little stuffed animals.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So I don't know that it really necessarily worked, but it didn't bother me in the movie for some reason.
I always pictured, you know, each of the stuffed animals, and this is from my earliest memories, I always pictured each of the stuffed animals being a gift from his father when he returns from his business travels. You know, Kanga and Roo from when his father had to go to Australia for business, and mm-hmm. Tigger from when his father had to go to India for business. They're all British Empire things.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah.
Although Eeyore, you know, I, for some reason, I always just associated him with Don Quixote.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, a child's imagination is an amazing thing. And I remember thinking when I was little, you know, all the little stories that I would dream up and my imaginary friends that I didn't really expect anybody else to see or know were there. They were my friends. And I think that the idea of losing your childhood, losing sight of your childhood, and having your childhood come and rescue you is kind of interesting. But at the same time, like I said, it didn't bother me in the movie. There was no suspension of disbelief there.
Mm-hmm.
Or no problem with a suspension of disbelief. Let's put that
no
way.
No need for it. Yeah.
There was no need for it. It just worked. The movie worked. So it didn't bug me. But I think that there would have been value if, I don't know that it would have been valuable that he was losing his mind, but I think there would have been some value in that they weren't actually moving, talking characters, that they were still stuffed animals would have been.
If they had gone the losing his mind route, it would have turned dark, very, very dark, very quickly.
Dark. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, it worked for me. The story worked. And in a level of ridiculousness that kind of story needed in order to come to its climax. And so it didn't bother me. And I don't know. I just think that we all need a little bit of fantasy and a little bit of imagination in our lives. And so, you know, I think it worked.
Yeah, I agree.
It was the fantasy and the imagination that saved him. So, you know, it was nice that it was real.
Yeah, I think this movie had a really nice balance of deep themes and childlike imagination. It really was well balanced. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a great happy movie, but it was
entertaining.
It was an artistic experience that was very entertaining. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's a good way to put it. An artistic experience that was entertaining. And there was a little bit of philosophy in there, you know, the whole perspective thing. So, I mean, it hit all its bases, and I think it was fun and worth watching, and I think we can recommend it if people are into that kind of movie. And we would definitely like to know what everybody else thinks. You can comment on the show notes, which will be at areyoujustwatching.com/84. You can call us at 903-231-2221 and leave us a voicemail. You can email us feedback@areyoujustwatching.com, and you can send us audio files if you want. You can join our Facebook discussion group. Just go on to Facebook and look for Are You Just Watching. There's a page and a group. Like the page, join the group. You can subscribe, rate, and review us in iTunes, and I believe that Google is now starting up a new podcasting media, so
really?
I'm sure that we'll work our way into that as well. I've been hearing about that, and
I hadn't seen
I'm sure that, yeah, I'm sure that our podcast will be available through there. So if you want to do the Google route instead of the Apple route, I'm sure you'll be able to find us. You can follow me on Twitter at Eve Franklin.
And you can follow me on Twitter at Rencheple, RENCHEPLE.
And we don't want to forget our supporters. We're very grateful to Amanda John, Craig Hardy, Richard French, and Stephen Brown II for their monthly support. We
thank you.
Strongly encourage you to go to patreon.com/areyoujustwatching and consider a small monthly gift to keep us, our podcast, going. We really appreciate those who are giving a gift, no matter how small, to keep us running. And it is so useful to us.
Yeah.
And I think we haven't necessarily decided what we're doing next month. So you can always send us suggestions. We're open to anything that's out on DVD. Within reason, we try to not do anything rated R.
Yep.
And we are, and anything coming into the movie theaters as well.
Yeah, we should have this posted by Labor Day. So,
and join us and let us know how we did. And I do want to thank those who engaged us after the Red Pill discussion. We did have a little bit of a discussion on our page about that.
Thank you.
Yeah, and thank you so much for continuing to listen to this podcast. We are well into our 9th year. We'll be 10 next year, I believe. So I've been doing the podcast a while. Tim hasn't been doing it.
I'm going on 3 years now, aren't I?
Yeah. Yeah. So we really appreciate those who have stuck with us through all of this, and hopefully we'll continue to bring the podcast to you in time to come. So thank you so much. I'm Eve Franklin.
I'm Tim Martin.
And don't just watch. Are You Just Watching is a proud member of Noodle Mix Network. Subscribe to more of our podcasts to make you think, laugh, and succeed at noodlemix.net.